Hi, good morning. I hope we have the line open. This is Denise Esposito at Covington & Burling. I'm here with my colleagues, all of whom are on your agenda today. We want to thank everyone for joining today's briefing call. This is obviously a fast-developing situation with COVID-19, and we're seeing developments daily that affect all of our life sciences clients. What we're planning on doing today is we're going to focus first on information that's relevant to our life sciences clients who are developing medical countermeasures against COVID-19 and what we see the government doing to facilitate that development and deployment of medical countermeasures. We're also going to touch on liability implications, both from the government immunity perspective and commercial private product liability perspective. And then we're going to open it up more broadly and talk more about, regardless of whether you're working on a countermeasure, implications of the COVID-19 outbreak on business continuity and supply chain GXP considerations, which are affecting all of our clients in this space. And then lastly, commercial and financial matters. If you have any questions following the webinar, don't hesitate to reach out to any of us on this call. We're doing a lot of work in this space, and we're seeing what's going on across the industry. We're happy to answer questions, small and large. So again, this is Denise Esposito. I'm going to kick us off with a focus on HHS and FDA activities and the evolving policies of the department and FDA with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic. So FDA and HHS both have statutory emergency authorities to deploy in the event of a pandemic or an act of warfare or bioterrorism. It requires one of the secretaries, in this case HHS, to issue declarations of a public health emergency. And there are some nuances which we won't get into today, but the important thing for you to know is that Secretary Azar has deployed the emergency use authorities under both Section 564 of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and Section 319 of the Public Health Service Act. And on February 4th, the declaration, the determination of a public health emergency also gave the secretary the authority to start to think about issuing what they call declarations, that emergency use authorizations for unapproved medical products or unapproved uses of approved medical products can be issued by FDA. So going back to the beginning of February, Secretary Azar did issue the public health determination. He determined that there's a public health emergency that has a significant potential to affect both national security and public health. On the same day, he issued a declaration authorizing FDA to issue what were called emergency use authorizations for in vitro diagnostics to detect the presence of COVID-19 in patients who are ill and meet other criteria. FDA has now issued two EUAs, a third one this morning, yesterday, so three EUAs under that declaration. CDC now holds an emergency use authorization to deploy certain tests under that authority, as does the New York State Department of Health. And then yesterday, we saw FDA issue the first emergency use authorization to a private sector company, Roche Diagnostics, is now able to run COVID-19 tests on its COVID system under that emergency use authorization. For those of you who aren't familiar with emergency use authorizations, it's basically a tool that enables FDA to permit the distribution and use of medical countermeasures in the event of a public health emergency without marketing authorization. So for drugs, that means that you don't have an NDA or a BLA, or you don't have an NDA or BLA for this indication. So you could have a drug that's approved, but not for this indication. And for devices, you know, you don't have the appropriate approval or clearance, but FDA lets you deploy that product typically in connection with a government contract or a government program, but we're seeing more flexibility in some commercial distribution because of the strain that COVID-19 is putting on the healthcare system. So basically, the thing to take away from that is that if you don't have marketing authorization, but you believe you have a product that may be safe and effective to treat or prevent or diagnose this disease, you can go to FDA and start to work with them on whether they're willing to let you distribute the product for emergency use. I'm going to back up now and talk about what FDA has done so far in terms of issuing emergency use authorizations. So the first tranche was the diagnostics. The second tranche was respirators to be used in the healthcare setting by healthcare professionals who need to wear protective gear to treat patients with COVID-19. The agency authorized the use of industrial respirators in addition to any respirators that are approved as medical devices by FDA, and that went through a CDC authorization process. And then, as I mentioned earlier, yesterday, an EUA was issued for a high-throughput COVID-19 diagnostic process on the Roche COVID system. This is all publicly available information, and we are putting together some materials for those of you who have reached out to us to ask what these precedents mean for you. One last point about HHS and FDA is that they have not yet issued a declaration enabling FDA to issue EUAs for vaccines or therapeutics. I spoke with FDA yesterday about this and asked whether they were planning on doing that. And my understanding is what they're going to do is they're going to issue it when they have the first therapeutic or vaccine EUA ready to go. So we don't expect to see that in advance. We may be working with the government to see if we can facilitate that. But so far, the only authorizations that are out there are for diagnostics and for respirators. So the HHS secretary would still need to issue a declaration for categories of therapeutics or vaccines or for specific subcategories before FDA would be authorized to issue an emergency use authorization for one of your specific products. One other important point about EUAs that I'm going to mention is that Jennifer Plitch, my partner, is going to talk about this in a moment, but the secretary has also issued a PREP Act declaration that provides certain liability protections for medical countermeasures deployed in the context of a public health emergency. And the EUA process is one process that loops you into those kinds of immunities. So if you're thinking about whether to go to FDA and seek an EUA or a treatment IND, it's also important to think about the way that those mechanisms will tag into your liability protections under the PREP Act. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Plitch to talk about the PREP Act itself.
Thanks, Denise. So I'm going to cover a couple of topics that will include the PREP Act, but that will probably cover a couple topics first before we get to the PREP Act. So I'm the co-chair of Covington's government contracts practice, and we've been working with life sciences companies for quite some time in the biodefense space. And so we've been dealing with lots of clients on a number of questions. First would be government opportunities that exist as a result of the outbreak. The government needs help and industry partners. Products that might be eligible, contract opportunities, as well as funding that's available to the various health agencies thanks to the supplemental appropriation and other sources. I'm also going to talk about some issues that you should think about as you're discussing or collaborating with the government, including IP considerations and other compliance considerations, as well as the implications of the Defense Production Act, whether you choose to collaborate with the government or not. That's an authority that the government can exercise, at least with regard to domestic production and activity. And lastly, a discussion of liability protection options, including, most importantly, the PREP Act and the declaration that was issued yesterday. So that's a lot to cover in not a lot of time. So we're going to move quickly and at a relatively high level, but we're happy to answer follow-up questions. So since the outbreak sort of hit our shores, the government has been reaching out to its existing industry partners first in the hopes of working together to develop vaccines, therapeutics, diagnostics, and medical devices that could be of assistance. They have also made public a number of opportunities. We have a couple of blogs that outline these in more detail, but they have put forward what's called an Easy BAA, the broad agency announcement in which they would hope to make awards within 30 days. It takes away a lot of the usual contracting red tape to hope to get to quick and flexible solutions. The Easy BAA extends to diagnostic products. Initially, it was just in vitro diagnostics, but it has since been expanded, so that authority is out there. Secondly, BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, which is resident within HHS, has been taking the lead in all contracting opportunities. So even though there's lots of places within DOD, certainly NIH, CDC, that are interested in these issues, BARDA is generally taking the lead, and they also have put out what is essentially a market research platform. So it's a way for them to gather information about products, devices, or anything else that might assist in responding to the outbreak. And that's easily accessible, and you just provide a packet of information, and if they think, if they're interested, they'll be in touch. Lastly, BARDA has recently amended its longstanding BAA, broad agency announcement, to include a number of COVID-focused items. So what they've said is they've had the BAA. So what a BAA is rather than a standard RFP, which says we want to buy X, a BAA puts out an announcement that says we have this problem. How do you propose to solve it? And then it gives responders the freedom to respond and say we have X, Y, or Z technologies that we think would be helpful for this reason. So those BAAs sit out there to cover a variety of different topics, but what BARDA has done now is they have made explicit that they are prioritizing proposal submissions for COVID-19, not surprising, and that covers everything from diagnostic assays to point-of-care assays, vaccines, therapeutics, therapeutics targeting lung repair, pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis, ventilators, you know, all the things you'd expect they'd be looking at. So those are things to take a look at if you think you want to collaborate with the government on these issues. And the government's contract authority is both broad and varied. So, you know, often scary for potential collaborators is the federal acquisition regulations, which have a number of compliance obligations. HHS has a much more flexible authority known as an other transaction authority. The reason that that's important is because it cuts through a lot of the competition requirements so that the agency can move quickly, and it also removes the FAR requirements and the Bayh-Dole requirements. Now, the government often tries to write those back in, but it does give parties complete flexibility, with a few exceptions, to negotiate a deal that works for both sides. And not surprising in light of the urgency of the problem, we have seen some flexibility from government collaborators that we have not seen in, you know, the last 20 years of working with them. So, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And they also, the other piece here, as probably many of you know, is that the government does have significant funds at its disposal. And in some cases, not only do they have these funds, but they also have a mandate to spend them quickly. So the $8.3 billion supplemental gave CDC $2.2 billion to use over the next couple of years to prevent, prepare for, and respond to coronavirus. FDA has money as well, as does NIAID within NIH, to make efforts to prevent, prepare for, and respond. ASPR and BARDA has probably the largest tranche of money, $3.1 billion, that's flexible to be used for the prevention, preparedness, and response measures related to coronavirus, including the development of countermeasures and vaccines, which they're working on, with a priority for platform-based technologies that can be manufactured in the United States. So there definitely is a focus at this point about domestic capacity, which is not what the government would like it to be for lots of reasons, with an eye towards being able to take care of American citizens. There are requirements that products have to be purchased at a fair and reasonable price. There was a lot of debate over this provision Fair and reasonable pricing is something that exists in every government contract. The government always has to seek and cannot purchase with appropriated funds unless they're paying a fair and reasonable price. So although that sounds somewhat daunting, it's actually not. It's just a provision that's always in government contracts. There's also some language in the appropriations about affordability in the commercial market. Again, the statute has made clear that this is all within existing law. So there's no new requirements with regard to affordability. It's just that the secretary should try to work towards making it affordable in the commercial market using existing law, which, you know, there's some debate as to how far that can take them. So that's the current state of affairs with regard to contracting opportunities. The government is in need of new technologies, obviously, to respond, and so we encourage folks to give that a consideration. As you're thinking of collaborating with the government, there are a couple of things that you should think about with regard to compliance, whether it's FAR compliance or other requirements that's imposed by statute. And then probably the most notable for life science contractors is IP considerations. So under the Bayh-Dole Act, which applies to most procurements, if the government funds certain work, they get certain rights. The way that it works at the moment under Bayh-Dole is that if there are inventions, so if something is either conceived of or actually reduced to practice in the performance of a government contract, the contractor has the right to patent anything, any subject inventions that are patentable, and the U.S. gets a license in that technology. It's a worldwide, non-exclusive, paid-up license to use the technology on behalf of the government, which is a somewhat limited right. They can't commercialize the product to compete with you, but they can, in times of emergency, use that license to have others manufacture. So as you're entering into either research and development, particularly research and development agreements, to collaborate with the government, it's important to think about what IP you're bringing to the table already and protect it so the government doesn't get access to your background IP, and then also to closely consider what subject inventions might come out of the collaboration and what impact that could have on your business. One example of that might be, as we said, the government is looking for platform technologies. So if you're collaborating with the government on using your platform technology to respond to the coronavirus, you also have to think about, well, what rights are they getting and what impact could they have on our use of that platform technology with regard to other disease states. It's not an impossible thing to work around. It's just something you need to understand the rules of on the way in and be careful. The other option, as I said, is that other transaction authority agreements give you freedom to even, Bayh-Dole doesn't apply. And so while the government will still be seeking some rights in inventions and in data, you have some flexibility to negotiate, rather than the one-size-fits-all, to negotiate special considerations in light of your technology. As I mentioned at the beginning, one of the concerns with collaborating with the government is that the government will get authority, will get power over your IP or your production capacity. The Defense Production Act is a statute that was enacted around the Korean War, which is going to give the government some authority with that regard already for any domestic facilities. So under the Defense Production Act, the Secretary of Health and Human Services has been delegated the authority to issue either allocation directives involving health resources or prioritization orders. So basically under the DPA, the government can, if you have an existing contract with them that has a rated order, make you fill their orders first. And if that's not the case, they also have the authority to use allocation directives to take any, to use facilities in the United States for U.S. purposes, or to seek the provision of any stockpiled or inventory doses you may have present in the U.S. Now, this is an extreme authority. It hasn't been used, particularly the allocation authority, since the Cold War, but it is a possibility. It's also something that you may see the government threatening in an effort to leverage negotiations. So they may not intend or want to ever actually use it, but the threat of using it can be useful for them to bring people to the table. So last but not least, I'm going to talk a bit about the PREP Act. So obviously a concern of entering into this space is that you're going to be moving quickly. and that there are going to be inherent hazards in the work that's being done. In light of that, Congress in 2005 enacted the PREP Act to address liability concerns raised by the use and distribution of countermeasures for biodefense uses or responding to emerging infectious diseases. The PREP Act essentially authorizes the Secretary of HHS to issue a declaration which provides covered individuals and entities protection from suit or liability under federal and state law for any losses relating to the administration or use of specifically identified countermeasures. So what that means is the government has given immunity if you qualify for PREP Act protection under the declaration, and one was issued yesterday for this with retroactive effect to February 4th of this year. You then would be immune from any suit in the United States, whether it be state and federal or federal court, for damages incurred as a result of the deployment of various countermeasures, which at the moment can include, well, they can include any vaccines, therapeutics, diagnostics, et cetera, with the caveat, as Denise mentioned earlier, that the EUA authority with regard to vaccines and therapeutics is not yet been given. So there may be some delay with regard to protection on therapeutics and vaccines as opposed to diagnostics. The important thing to keep in mind is that the PREP Act only applies to countermeasures themselves and to certain activities as are identified in the declaration itself. The declaration is relatively broad, which is good, but it does provide that protection is only going to be available if either it's the work being done, the countermeasure in question, and the activity is related to a present or future federal contract, cooperative, which includes cooperative agreements, grants, other transaction authority agreements, memorandum of understanding, any basic federal agreement must be related to, or it has to be an activity that's been authorized in accordance with public health and medical response of an authority having jurisdiction. So you basically have to be told to do, your activity has to be authorized by an appropriate public health authority that to deliver or administer a covered countermeasure following the declaration of an emergency. There are a couple of limitations with regard to PREP Act liability protection. It does not apply to suits brought elsewhere under other nations' laws. So if you're doing clinical trials in China, for example, and you are face a lawsuit in China, the PREP Act is not necessarily going to assist you. And in addition, it does not cover anything that is not related to a government contract. So if you are working independently, or if you ultimately distribute something in the commercial market without a link to a government contract, you do still face potential liability concerns. And to respond to those risks, those residual risks, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Ambrosio to talk about.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Again, this is Mike Ambrosio. I'm the co-chair of the Covington's Mass Torts and Products Liability Practice. We've been giving thought to ways that the plaintiff's bar, when all the dust settles, may try to get around the fairly broad protections of the PREP Act. As Jen said, the provisions are quite broad. If you look at Romans 7 of Azar's declaration yesterday, it's pretty broad and should cover most of what you're doing. But the key linchpin is it's got to be done essentially in agreement with or in consultation with or at the direction of some federal or state body. Obviously, you know, there may be some companies that want to do things on their own to, you know, protect their IP or otherwise avoid other government intrusion, and that will come with some risk. It remains to be seen whether the plaintiff's bar is going to be especially aggressive or have a great interest in this. You know, there are two potential risks that could happen. One is something doesn't work. I think that's a really small risk. I think it's very difficult in normal settings to bring lack of efficacy claims. I think it's especially difficult in this setting where everyone is rightly trying to think of creative ways to confront this issue. The other is some sort of untoward side effect that could happen. And I think it's especially the case for, you know, some of these biologics, whether on the market or not, they are serious medicines with serious side effects. And one can imagine, you know, there are some medicines on the market now, some biologics that have been reported to have some use in treating the impact of COVID-19. And those medicines are serious medicines. And one can imagine side effects arising from those, especially if the product is not effective in treating the underlying disease, that you could see having one-off interest in individual lawsuits. I think it's still a relatively unlikely scenario, but one that we need to keep a very close eye on. I think the only other thing to think about is physicians out there who are deciding to use these otherwise commercially available medicines in some sort of off-label or experimental way because they read about it on the internet or they're desperate to try anything for very sick patients. I think that's always going to raise a risk. I think, again, that risk is probably, at least at this stage, fairly minor. If a physician uses something off-label and there's an untoward effect, I think, you know, most would view that as a risk worth taking, probably one that is not driven by the company, although we do need to be careful in our public statements about overstating the potential benefit of what is still an unknown or untested treatment. So that's as far as for the products lawyers on the phone, those, I think that's the key advice to give to your clients, that to just be cautious about being too overly optimistic about the potential use and benefits of unapproved medicines. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions down the road or folks have my information, but let me turn it over now to Grant and Denise to talk about some of the supply chain and business continuity issues.
Thank you, Mike. I'm Grant Castle. I head up the life sciences regulatory practice in Europe. And we're going to change tack a little bit, and we're going to talk about the impact of COVID-19 on business continuity. I mean, many people on the phone will have been thinking about business continuity issues, thinking about whether they should be working from home. But here we're really focusing on what happens if COVID-19 impacts your ability to comply with regulatory obligations, impacts your regulatory structures, perhaps because a facility or office closes. We'll talk about risk mitigation and impact mitigation and some of the regulatory issues that might flow from those risk or impact mitigation measures. I'm going to talk about regulatory obligations and supply chains, and Denise is going to add some thoughts if she would like to, and then we're going to hand over to Paula Katz, who's going to talk about GxP compliance and some of the issues arising there. So as regards regulatory obligations for approved drugs, if you're a BLA or an NDA holder or a marketing authorization holder in the EU, you're going to be required to fulfill a range of obligations that arise because of your status. Those include pharmacovigilance, medical affairs and medical information services. And it's possible that your ability to comply with those and other obligations could be impacted if you're needing to shut down parts of your business operations. I mean, what are the possible risk mitigation measures? Well, many of them will be the same as the kinds of measures that most companies are thinking about. Has the company put in place remote working capabilities? Could the people within your pharmacovigilance group do exactly what they do in the office day to day remotely? Could they have access to the global safety database? Could they be keeping an eye on the working of those systems? Other potential options include scope for delegations and outsourcing. Most laws and guidelines in this space recognize that a product registration holder can delegate or outsource the performance of its regulatory tasks, although it often cannot delegate the associated responsibilities and hence liabilities. It may be too late, but you need to be thinking about whether you can put in place contingency arrangements, either intra-company or with third-party vendors that could be brought to bear if your business is seriously disrupted. I suppose you just need to then be mindful, and this will be a theme, of possible regulatory consequences of those delegations or outsourcings. An example might be in the EU, the requirements that the marketing authorization holder sets out in detail the way in which its pharmacovigilance system operates and the entities or individuals who play a role in that. And that must be available in your pharmacovigilance system master file for inspection by the authorities. Obviously, if you're adjusting the way in which you conduct pharmacovigilance, you will need to reflect that in changes to your pharmacovigilance system master file, because running a pharmacovigilance system other than in accordance with the description in your pharmacovigilance system master file is not permitted. So you just need to think through those issues. I suspect many regulators would be sympathetic given that they're also facing challenges in regulating. Now, when you turn to the pharmaceutical supply chain, the issues may be even more acute because manufacturing facilities and distribution facilities may be impacted. I know a number of companies, both in the pharmaceutical and the medical device space, are thinking about this. What if a major distribution hub is disabled because of COVID-19? What if a major manufacturing facility has to cease operating because of similar concerns? Now, I suppose the first thing to do is to think about whether your supply chain already has built-in redundancy and backup arrangements. That has been a focus, particularly for manufacturers in recent years amongst regulators. Regulators have been interested to understand whether a manufacturing supply chain has built-in redundancies. They're often suspicious if there is only a single source of API and no alternative. So you might be surprised to find that you already have some backup or redundancy arrangements in place. If you don't, then you may need to think about potential outsourcing options. Now, this is obviously easier when you're talking about distribution than when you're talking about manufacturing operations. But there may be certain aspects of manufacturing operations that could be outsourced. The GMP rules, both in the US and the EU, envisage that manufacturers can outsource certain of their functions, and that might include laboratory or QC testing, provided they maintain adequate levels of control. For distribution arrangements, it's generally going to be much more straightforward, although you may need to identify and rely on other logistics services providers. But again, whenever you're thinking about this, you need to consider potential impacts on your NDA, BLA, or marketing authorizations, because obviously manufacturers both of API and finished product will be identified in those dossiers, and products will be approved on the basis of that. So if you're going to make a substantial change, you should be reaching out to the regulators to discuss them. Finally, it may be the case that disruption in your supply chain results in shortages or potential shortages in a market. Now, in many jurisdictions, marketing authorization holders and distributors are under a legal obligation to ensure continuity of supply to the relevant market. And there will also often be an obligation to report to or notify authorities if a company foresees potential shortages. So as soon as you feel that a disruption caused by COVID may result in shortages in medicines in a particular jurisdiction, you need to be thinking about reporting that or notifying the authorities so that you can work together to implement a fix. Denise, I don't know whether you have any additional observations or thoughts before we hand over to Paula.
Thanks. It's Denise Esposito again. I guess the one thing that I'll add before turning it over to Paula Katz, who's going to talk about GXP considerations in the U.S., is that we are getting a lot of requests about how to handle reporting of potential disruptions in supply and drug shortages to FDA. So there is a legal requirement to report some drug shortages to FDA depending on the circumstances. And so we're very focused on when those are triggered. And if you need advice on that, we can walk you through it. And then also you can voluntarily report a drug shortage to FDA, even if you're not statutorily obligated to do that. And one of the benefits of that is that if you have alternative suppliers or ex-US sources of product that aren't authorized to be shipped in, but you know that they it's a same or similar product, you can work with the drug shortages staff to get various waivers of import-export requirements, GXPs, et cetera. So I think one thing to keep in mind is if you see your supply chain being disrupted, trying to figure out how much inventory you have and if and when it's going to impact distribution. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Paula Katz.
Thanks, Denise. This is Paula Katz again in the Washington office here at Covington. And that's a great segue to talking about GXPs, because I think the biggest issue to keep in mind, and for those of you who are wondering what GXP is, we're talking about folks whose internal clients are going to include manufacturing, quality, R&D, clinical trials, operations, et cetera. The biggest thing to keep in mind is that nothing fundamentally changes in light of this event in terms of your requirements, right? The GXP rules are not going to go away. There are some potential opportunities for the agency, for example, to waive certain requirements, but they're likely not going to. But what is going to happen, I think, is that we're going to see some flexibility, some creativity, and some opportunities on both sides of the table, really, for the agency to think about creative ways to solve problems and for clients to propose alternatives and options. As a normal course, GXP processes always have to be validated and documented, whether we're talking about with respect, for example, to clinical trials or to manufacturing, right? Validation and documentation are central issues in any GXP process, but the likelihood that you're going to have some deviations in light of what's going on with COVID-19 has increased, of course. So taking a risk-based approach, as we would always advise, is going to be critical here in order to understand what regulatory flexibility you might request and how to tee issues up for the agencies in terms of getting them to understand what novel approaches and resolutions you can propose. And, in the fall, Dr. Woodcock from CDER was on the Hill and testified when she was being asked even then about FDA's understanding of supply chain issues. She talked about how little the agency really does know and how much it depends on companies to tell it about what's going on. And she also talked about the value of reliance on and development of emerging technologies in resolving shortages and supply chain problems. So, again, you saw Dr. Hahn this week on the Hill being grilled about COVID-19, and he also talked about the potential for emerging technologies in this space. So I think where you can leverage those ideas, and this is a great opportunity, again, to partner with the agency along the lines Jennifer was talking about, with BARDA and with others in proposing alternative technologies and alternative approaches to fulfilling the existing requirements. I think that's going to be valuable for companies in this space. I think, as a practical matter, what are we going to be hearing questions about? We're getting everything from can we change over manufacturing lines to produce different things to, how do we get our teams to continue to do their required activities. if they're not able to come in or if they're being asked to distance socially, right? Obviously, considering electronic and teleworking alternatives, where that can be done in a way that protects the security of data that is required for regulatory compliance is an important idea. Considering electronic inspections and desk audits of supply chain partners so that you can reduce the need for travel to different sites. You know, how is this going to affect inspections is certainly a question we're hearing a lot. FDA at least has started to provide some information about that. This week, the agency announced that it is postponing most foreign inspections, except for those that are deemed mission critical. Obviously, the elephant in the room is which ones will be deemed mission critical, where and how are they going to coordinate on those with both foreign health authorities and foreign ministries of state and foreign affairs, but also understanding from a public health perspective, which ones are considered mission critical right now may look very different than under other circumstances. And FDA has not yet said anything about how all of this may affect domestic inspections. And that's also an important consideration for many of you on the line. Many of you have domestic facilities or at least operations that are subject to inspection. FDA has not made any public statements about this, but I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that the agency is dealing with the same issues at a very practical level as you are, right? How is it going to deploy its workforce? Does it want to put them at risk? Does it want to keep them socially distant, if possible? And so I think you can expect that, if FDA shows up for an inspection and you've got the critical people who would normally need to be there for an inspection working remotely because of COVID-19, I think you can ask for, and I think the agency is likely to be amenable to some flexibility about conducting inspections, about timing, and certainly about sharing information, maybe electronically if that's something sites are comfortable with. Another issue that's cropped up in the inspection space, of course, is FDA's authority to request records in advance of or even in lieu of inspections. FDA has had this authority since 2012 under the FDASIA amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. It's exercised this authority in a couple of different spots, and it does have explicit authority to do so under certain public health emergencies. But even as early as February, FDA announced that it was exercising this authority with respect to China. And I think we can expect to see increasing uses of this authority, again, in conjunction with agencies' announcement about postponing foreign inspections. I think FDA will continue to increasingly ask for records in advance of inspections. Certainly in the manufacturing space, whether that authority also applies to other types of inspections is a question that we've been working through for other types of inspections. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that when there are fewer inspections, either domestically or certainly abroad, the agency is going to be potentially relying more heavily on some of its other authorities and tools for maintaining the safety and continuity of supply and balancing those issues for drugs here in the U.S. So you might see some changes in approaches to screening at the borders, although it would be, I think, challenging for the agency to ramp up operations in the current circumstances. But import alerts, for example, are relatively easy for the agency to put into place. And so that is a tool that agency might rely on more heavily, at least in the near term, while it's unable to conduct inspections everywhere it might wish to. So I wanted to touch briefly on some issues specific to clinical trials. I think in many ways they're no different, again, from other aspects of GXP. Again, protocol compliance in particular could be impacted by things like closure, travel bans. You might see challenges in site qualification and monitoring, in closures of hospitals and clinics, or shifting of resources at healthcare facilities to address the pandemic. It might be more challenging, of course, to conduct patient visits. You'll see challenges with delivery of trial materials, sampling and testing, and of course, recruitment and enrollment. So the protocol that you may already have in place may face an uptick in deviations. FDA has not, to my knowledge, made any statements about this, although MHRA recently made a statement indicating that an uptick in deviations is not going to be in and of itself. Deviations from your trial protocol will not in and of itself be considered a serious breach of GCP. They recognize and understand that there's likely to be an uptick in deviations from trial protocols, but the important thing, of course, is to continue, again, to document deviations, and as you would already be required to. And then, again, to escalate deviations when they represent a serious risk to patients. And that's no different than under normal circumstances. You may see more of those, but it's not a different requirement per se. And some of the same kinds of risk mitigations could be applicable in the clinical trial context, as elsewhere, of course, thinking about remote monitoring and alternatives like phone calls and video monitoring for oversight. And doing so under documented risk assessments when you make those kinds of changes. Of course, thinking about ensuring consent to sharing of information, if those changes that you're making into your protocol are changes to what your subject originally consented to. So those are just some high-level issues that we've seen. And Denise, did you have anything you wanted to add on trials?
The only thing I would say on clinical trials, and Paul alluded to this, is that we are seeing disruptions not only in drug supply, but also the inability of study subjects to appear for in-person appointments, and we're fielding some questions around how, if at all, you can make protocol adjustments to account for that with the use of telemedicine, possibly electronic solutions to patient reporting, electronic health records, and then also to be thinking about if any of your clinical trial sites are going to be redeployed to take care of COVID-19 patients, they might not have capacity at all to take on clinical trial study subjects, depending on how the hospital is set up to handle that. So those are just some key issues to think about, and think about whether you're going to work with your IRB to change a protocol, and whether, if you're concerned about it affecting the ability to collect data that would be acceptable for regulatory decision making, that you think about whether to engage with FDA on those protocol deviations.
Thanks, Denise. And I'm going to hand it over now to my colleague, Nigel Howard, to talk about commercial and financial issues.
Thanks, Paula. Thanks, Denise. That was really interesting. This is Nigel Howard. I'm the co-chair of Covington's Tech Transactions Practice. And my comments will focus on two sets of tips. Firstly, tips on how to analyze rights under existing commercial contracts. And second, tips on how to approach drafting of new force majeure provisions. As with any contract analysis, you should start with as many of the facts and context as possible. In particular, does the contract have a force majeure provision? Does it require notice and mitigation? Are other provisions relevant, such as a termination for convenience right? And when was the contract signed, and what is the governing law? And finally, it's important to understand the facts and the relevant business and operational objectives. Catch-all force majeure provisions are generally construed narrowly, so COVID-19 is more likely to qualify if the provision expressly refers to topics such as epidemic and pandemic or similar terms. COVID-19 may also qualify if the force majeure provision expressly refers to circumstances that have resulted from COVID-19. So that could include government actions and orders. Some force majeure provisions in life sciences transactions may require evidence from a competent authority or a local chamber of commerce. However, such specific provisions can lead to some practical problems. Competent authorities are often defined in these agreements as the regulatory authorities with authority for approvals for bringing a drug to market. And those authorities may not be the ones issuing orders in relation to COVID-19, or they may not be willing to judge a company's ability to perform its contractual obligations. In some jurisdictions, evidence from a local chamber of commerce may only be available to corporations in that country. So there may be some practical problems. Those, of course, could include the fact that the competent authority may not be responsive at this time or even functioning. Having said all that, any certificate or document from a government or foreign government body could be relevant for your analysis of a force majeure provision. Please note that the analysis will be fact-specific and depend on the jurisdiction of the contract. For example, in some jurisdictions, a causal link between COVID-19 and the non-performance will be required. In other jurisdictions, the event must also have been unforeseeable at the time of contracting. The jurisdiction may also be a significant factor as to whether the affected party has a duty to mitigate. So, for example, the obligation to mitigate is strongly emphasized in New York and California courts, but Texas courts are more lenient with respect to obligations to find alternatives. There's a duty to mitigate under English law, but by contrast, in Singapore, this duty may or may not apply depending on the wording of the provision. Government requisitions, which we already heard about, manufacturing capacity, present a special case under commercial contracts too. So the commercial contract obviously wouldn't be with the government, but if the force majeure refers to government actions, then requisitions may fall squarely within the force majeure provision in the commercial contract with the other customers. Although note the duty to mitigate would still apply with respect to those other customers. So let's turn now to drafting of new force majeure provisions in light of COVID-19. The clause typically starts with the language excusing one or both parties from performing the contract if the specified event occurs. So here we have to consider what standard will apply in light of COVID-19. Should the provision require complete prevention of performance before it will apply, or will delays or failure to perform in part also trigger the provision? COVID obviously should be called out expressly in the force majeure provision, but because it is a foreseen and known risk at the current time, the drafting will need to go a step further. For instance, consider establishing a communication and governance process for specific expenditures that may be necessary to continue performance under the contract, such as new sanitation and trash removal costs would need to be dealt with. Also consider adjustments to volume and other discounts that would be triggered if only partial performance is possible, and adjustments to prices may be needed because of increases to cost and raw materials. Also consider options for rescheduling, alternative locations, and secondary sources, which a party may be responsible for, and on who's going to pay for those incremental costs. Also, any alternative sources may require an adjustment to exclusivity provisions. And if you are a customer, consider adding provisions regarding how the supplier will allocate the remaining resources between its customers. And finally, consider if the provision should have notice and express mitigation requirements, and whether a termination right, if any, should be available to one or both parties. We unfortunately have run out of time for today for questions, but I would encourage anyone who has a question to write to any of the speakers, or you can write to our general email box at events@cov.com. I also mentioned a couple of other programs that we have specifically in relation to COVID-19. We'll continue our webinar series next week with a call on Tuesday, March the 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern. That will be on the Workplace Guide to COVID-19, Solutions to Employment and Benefits Challenges. And then for those considering tax impacts of COVID-19, our tax colleagues have published a client alert on key considerations and opportunities from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and they will follow up with a briefing call on March the 24th. This information and other information can be found on our COVID-19 toolkit page, which is on our website at cov.com. And with that, I'll thank you for attending and ask that you all please stay for this difficult time.